based on the talks given during the previous days, today's Dhamma talk must be on what? Oh yes, indeed, on Panya, wisdom. Quite correct. And so, as before, let us go back to our initial verse from the Samyutta Nikaya. He or she who is possessed of constant virtue. And just a slight addition here. In the initial verse in the Visuddhimagga, the path of purification, says, based, well established on virtue. And please note the term there, well established. So one needs to be firmly grounded in Nisida. So possessed of constant virtue, one has understanding wisdom and is concentrated, is strenuous and diligent as well, will cross the flood so difficult to cross. Now, these verses are nice to listen to, but they do require some amount of explanations. And the question that might arise in this context is, well, how do we bring about how do we bring about wisdom? So just practicing morality or virtue, sila, will not be enough. Just practicing concentration will also not be enough. And there is a Dhammapada verse that's number 282 that very much speaks to this very point of the arising of wisdom. So the verse says, indeed, wisdom is born of meditation. Without meditation, wisdom is lost. Knowing this twofold path of gain and loss of wisdom, one should conduct oneself so that wisdom may increase. So this means that if one is not practicing meditation, one then it will be quite unlikely for wisdom to unfold. There'll be some initial wisdom arising based on reflections, but this is not really going very deep. And this kind of wisdom does not qualify as vipassana wisdom, as insight, knowledge or wisdom. And so, especially if one has not yet attained the first level of enlightenment, namely the path of the stream entry, Sotapattimagga, then one practices for some time and reaches a particular insight knowledge, and then the retreat is over, one goes back home. Then it's quite possible that if one doesn't continue with one's practice at home, that the wisdom gained during the retreat will fade away. At least the highest level that one has reached might not be present anymore. And therefore, the wisdom developed during an intensive retreat should be supported by practice, daily practice at home. The more one can practice, the better. Now, let's take a look at this factor of wisdom. What is actually meant by wisdom? And there are different forms of wisdom or understanding, and with different aspects to it. Now, intended here in our discussion is the understanding consisting in insight knowledge associated with profitable consciousness. And the Dhamma Sanghani, as so many times, is useful to refer back to in order to find out some synonyms for wisdom. And sometimes by knowing a synonym, this helps already a little bit for better understanding. So instead of wisdom, we can also say understanding or scrutiny of impermanence, of the impermanence, of the unsatisfactoriness and the selfless nature of phenomena. Also, we could say investigative knowledge of the Dhamma, or to put it differently, investigation of states, which is a term that you've heard before, that namely as the second of the what? The Bodhjangas, yes, the enlightenment factors, correct. And then furthermore, there is discriminative knowledge. So one work that I'm referring to, occasionally the Patthisamvidamagga, is known as the path of discrimination. So various kinds of knowledge are being dealt with there. And then furthermore, we have a comparative examination, then a penetrative wisdom, insight, or clear comprehension. Clear comprehension is a term for an initial form of wisdom, an incipient form of wisdom, that oftentimes gets mentioned in context of mindfulness. The Pali is sati and sampajanya. Sati meaning mindfulness, and sampajanya is clear comprehension. And then furthermore, there is non-bewilderment, investigative knowledge of the Dhamma, and right view. So all of these are different terms for wisdom. And the Pali terms for or the Pali term for wisdom is panya, for insight knowledge jnana, and for non-delusion it's amoha, and for investigation of states it's dhammavicaya, and right view would be sammadhiti. And the antonyms are avijja for ignorance, anjana is lack of insight and insight knowledge, and moha is delusion. Now, Visuddhimagga defines this wisdom panya in the following way. First of all, the general definition, namely that wisdom means knowing things according to reality, or knowing things as they truly are, as they really are. And this wisdom has the characteristic of penetrating things or objects according to their intrinsic nature, or according to their essential nature. The Pali for this is Pativeda Yata Sabhava Lakana. Yata Sabhava Pativeda Lakana. And the function of the wisdom is to illuminate an object or an objective field. Now, as an explanation for this function, when you start meditating and you try to observe your rising and falling movement of the abdomen, you may find it very difficult to really know what is happening there. And at first you might be just labeling as rising and falling, and at the most maybe you realize there is some expansion of the abdomen and some contraction during the falling movement. And or you might not even see it this much. And you might even confuse the rising movement with the falling movement. And this then would be a case of not knowing the true nature of the object. And at that some point, you're still bewildered about the nature of the object. So, and all of this is because certainly you're not seeing clearly. The object is not certainly illuminated. Now, whenever wisdom arises through practice, then the object itself becomes clear, and the nature of the object is then clearly known or seen. And so when you enter a dark room and the light bulb in there is out of order, and you walk into the room, and then it may very well happen that you bump into a table that is standing there, or into a cupboard, or you bump into the famous wall. However, as soon as you find a flashlight, and you switch on this flashlight, and then the light of this flashlight will dispel the darkness, it will illuminate the room, and with this you see what objects are in the room, and then you can walk around without hitting anything, without running into any object. And so it is said about certain wisdom that it dispels the darkness of delusion or ignorance. Now, as for the manifestation, the way this wisdom manifests in a meditator's mind, and this is given as non-bewilderment, non-confusion, or absence of confusion, or the dissipating of confusion. So, earlier on, at the beginning of this practice, you were bewildered about the nature. You were confused about the nature of the object, be it the rising and falling movement of the abdomen, or a pain, or whatever predominant object arises in the practice. However, now, with the arising of wisdom, you are no longer bewildered. You see things for what they really are. So in the rising movement, you see, for instance, the expansion, you see some tension there, maybe the tension is increasing, and then there's a pause certain between the end of the rising and the beginning of the next falling, and so on and so forth. And so the proximate cause, or the nearest cause that leads to the arising of wisdom, is given as wise attention, namely, directing one's mind or one's practice again and again towards the development of wisdom. And if one continuously does this, then eventually wisdom will arise. And so the second cause, proximate cause, for the arising of wisdom is what? And this we've discussed already in some of the previous Dhamma talks. Concentration, yes, very good, indeed. Concentration, or, as it is said in the text, the consolidation of the mind, or the unification of the mind. So, the bringing together, the unifying of the relevant mental states. So, a mind that is dissipated, that is distracted, cannot see things clearly, and cannot see the true nature of an object. However, once concentration is there, the mind is unified, collected, and then it becomes possible to see the true nature of an object. Now, when it comes to a wisdom, or to be more precise, intuitive wisdom, in the context of Vipassana meditation, then we can say that this wisdom performs various, or the different insight knowledges perform various functions. And I'll give you a couple of examples. And a meditator undertakes the contemplation of impermanence, and there's no need to do this intentionally, it will happen automatically in the course of the practice, and then with this, automatically this contemplation of impermanence will abandon the wrongful, perception of permanence, nicca sanya in the Pali language. So anicca, which means impermanence, takes the place of, you know, permanence nicca. So what we have here is the way that, you know, this function is that one form of insight knowledge, or a particular insight knowledge, takes the place of a wrongful perception. So it's by way of substitution that substitution of opposites, that a wrongful perception, or in other cases a wrongful view or idea, gets replaced by a correct view or idea or correct understanding. And as another example, when a meditator continues to practice after having seen the impermanence of certain formations, then it's quite likely that this meditator will come to understand that all formations, all conditioned formations, are subject to suffering or unsatisfactoriness. So this is the aspect of dukkha. And so this understanding, this intuitive understanding, will then take the place of the wrongful perception of objects as conducive to happiness or pleasure. So the dukkha then takes the place of sukha. And so this step two is important for the development of one's meditation practice. It's important as a preliminary step for the final attainment of Nibbana. Now, again, along the same line, when a meditator continues to practice, then he or she will understand the aspect of non-self. Now, this understanding of non-self, or the absence of a self, does not come through thinking, analyzing, reflection, or what have you, but rather it comes through direct experience, or through direct observation of what is really happening in the body and in the mind. And so once this intuitive insight has been gained, or while it is being gained, it replaces or abandons the wrongful perception as self, and or perception of a self, aptasanya in the Pali scriptural language. Now, of course, this is not on a permanent basis, but at least on a temporary basis. So usually, as non-meditators or beginning meditators, we are under the impression that there truly exists a self, or a soul, or an ego, or an I. And so we tenaciously hold on to this belief, or to this view. However, in the course of the practice, quite naturally, this view then gets dispelled, at least temporarily dispelled at this point, through the understanding of anatta. And again, it's by way of substitution of opposites that this happens. Then, later on in the practice, so that's let's say during the middle phase of the path of insight, that a meditator comes to perceive all formations, or see all formations, as disenchanting, as disgusting, and phenomena are not seen as attractive anymore. And so, or to put it again in different words, one gets fed up with all formations, no matter what the formations are. So even the ice cream that we have talked about during some previous Dhamma talk, even this is no longer seen as attractive. And what this particular insight knowledge does is, it abandons the delighting in formations. As human beings, we have a tremendous tendency to delight in formations. We want to see and we delight in this. We want to hear and we delight in this. Sometimes even if the seeing or the hearing or smelling isn't or involves some somewhat unpleasant object, still we want to see. We can't help not to see or look. And so in this case, in the case of this insight knowledge of disenchantment, the disenchantment takes the place of the delighting. And again, this is a necessary and preliminary stage or step for the attainment or realization of Nibbana. Now, this wisdom, from an Abhidhamma point of view, arises in all jhanas, so in all absorptions, and so it arises, of course, during the insight knowledges. It arises in path knowledge, so the moment when one level of enlightenment gets attained. It does also arise in fruition knowledge or consciousness, and furthermore, it arises in some of the sense sphere, beautiful consciousness associated with knowledge. And it does also arise in some sense sphere resultant, wholesome resultant consciousness. And furthermore, in some sense sphere functional consciousness. And it arises together with all beautiful universal mental states. So this wisdom, it's pretty similar to mindfulness, is or comes in association with wholesome mental states. And but to make this very clear, not with all. There's some in which it does not arise. Now, earlier on, it was pointed out in the words of initial Dhammapada verse that wisdom arises through meditation, and it is lost if one does not meditate. Are there any other factors that might contribute to the acquisition of wisdom? So, what do you think? What comes to your mind? Pardon me? Reflections? Yes, reflections might help, indeed. With a guru, well, I accept except for the word guru. So maybe with a teacher, or some person who has done the practice to some amount, and who has some amount of depth in the practice, some amount of wisdom. The more, the better, of course. Guru, because this is a term oftentimes used in the context of Hinduism. I know. So usually, if you say teacher, it sounds nicer. In Lumbini, they call me all the time, and so on. The local people, they call me all the time, Guruji, Guruji, and I can't hear it. Huh? No. Yeah, this is Tibetan Buddhism.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. In Theravada Buddhism, we don't have this. Well, never mind. So, anyway, association with a teacher indeed is one very important factor. And you will see in a minute, I'll give you 4 points as mentioned in the Samyutta Nikaya, leading to points leading to the acquisition of wisdom. Any other suggestions? Yes, Giga. Huh?
Sangha.
This is a good point. It's not mentioned. It's not mentioned here.
With, you know, the round of you, the people that practicing the same thing.
I fully agree.
Do it together. It's much more.
Right.
It's much, much easier.
Right. The association of like-minded people, indeed, like you say, very much helps for one's own meditation practice. And then one can discuss and get some or gain some inspiration from other meditators. And if you're all alone, practicing at home, and on top of this being criticized by your family or environment, then good luck. It's not going to be so easy. Now, any other suggestions? Yes, Sri? Pardon me? Yes, restraining the senses absolutely is correct. The joy. Yes, that comes automatically with the practice. At certain points, during certain insight knowledges, there's very little joy there. No? But in other phases of the practice, again, joy can become quite strong. So joy is indeed, it's an enlightenment factor, and definitely it contributes to the rising of enlightenment. Then, wait a minute, you had, yes, Asa?
Ethics and education.
Ethics and education.
Genetics.
Oh, genetics and why are you saying genetics? People have the genetics for it, and others don't. Well, if let's what about a compromise? If we, instead of saying genetics, if we say kamma, more precisely vipaka, the results, karmic results, wholesome karmic results from previous actions, then I would agree.
No. In the university, we call it genetics.
Oh, genetics. Yeah. Well, virtue. Yes, virtue is certainly indeed, and that's why. Again and again, the emphasis is on sila, samadhi, panya. No, but to one more point regarding you. People who have performed many wholesome deeds in a previous existence enjoy the fortune, the good fortune, of then being reborn into the human existence. This in itself is already a blessing. No, one could be reborn in some other, into some other realm, some less favorable realm. And then people who have performed a lot of wholesome deeds during a previous certain existence may be born or reborn with strong roots in the form of aloba, adosa, and amoha, meaning non-greed, non-hatred, and non-delusion. So if you happen to be one of those, then it's going to be very easy to do the practice. And at a young age, you'll be drawn to the practice, and when you actually do it, it will be progress might be quite quick.
And is this related to the parents?
It might be. And in Burma, there is by now, at least in the Vipassana community, a common understanding that children of parents who have ideally both, but at least otherwise minimum at least the mother, have both practiced meditation intensively and ideally even to a satisfactory level, those children tend to be well behaved and calm and considerate and respectful to the parents and so on and so forth.
And
No, this is apart from the education. even before attending, you know, kindergarten or primary school. And I remember the statement of a younger woman who has one daughter, and just before giving birth to her daughter, she did her intensive practice at the Mahasi Meditation Center. And she said, because of her intensive practice, her daughter was so charming and so nice and calm and considerate and so on.
She had the genes for the tendency to have intensive practice.
Oh, yeah, well, the genes, okay. That's what you're saying with the genes. Well, that's the modern biological explanation or version. Pardon me?
To divide people by genes.
Well, I'm not a specialist in this, and so definitely I don't want to get caught saying something that might be misinterpreted. Yes. Or at least let's keep that for the end of the retreat.
No, I mean, are you talking about
wisdom, position of wisdom, and factors leading to this?
No. Generally, or
in a retreat, no, in a retreat format. So, anyway, we've got a couple of good answers, and there is this very short sutta. Now, on this topic in the Samyutta Nikaya, and it's Samyutta 5 in paragraph 411, or the 55th Samyutta, 55th Sutta. Monastics or meditators, these four things, when developed and cultivated, lead to greatness of wisdom. What are they? What for? And the answer is, the very first answer is, association with superior persons or people who have practiced and have gained some wisdom. Then, secondly, very obvious point, hearing the true Dhamma. And so, being acquainted with the Dhamma, hearing the Dhamma, discussing the Dhamma, all of these sort of things help to bring about the unfolding of wisdom. Then, it's good to be around a teacher. It's also good to hear, let's say, Dhamma talks. But if one does not pay careful attention to what is being said, then much is lost, and then it would stop right there. One is present during during a Dhamma talk, but one is not getting much out of it. And sometimes what happens is one sits in during a Dhamma talk and the mind is filled with concepts, one's own concepts that one has picked up here and there and so on, and these concepts block the pure hearing of what's of the Dhamma. So it's important that noble hearing is a really important quality for a meditator. Only then, and this is the meaning of the term sāvaka. Sāvaka means a disciple, and a sāvaka is one who listens carefully, and it's the nobility aspect is even included in this. So, let us assume there's association with some wise person, there's hearing of the true Dhamma, there's on top of this careful attention to it, and then what else is missing? Yes?
Patience,
yes, is correct. Is absolutely correct. This quality you need in the past meditation. One further point. Pardon me? There you go. That's it. No, you actually have to do it. No, you have to get back to your cushion and do the work. Now, there are many people who, especially in traditionally Buddhist countries, they have thought, you know, they, you know, they're associated with a good teacher, and they hear the true Dhamma. They attend Dhamma talks, you know, once a week or several times a week, and then they even pay close attention to what is being said. But when it comes, and they're happy to perform acts of generosity, they're happy to keep the precepts, 5 precepts, 8 precepts, but when it comes to the actual practice of meditation, it's a no-no, no? And then you'll get to hear all sorts of excuses. Ah, now it's not the right time, and I have all these many obligations at home, my family, and so on. And so this fourth point also needs to be there. And let me add, maybe in this connection, that it's helpful to have some amount of time. 7 days, 10 days is actually, from a Vipassana point of view, a relatively short period of time. If you have more than this, if you could make available maybe a month or two or even three, it would be much better. And then really the practice can unfold, wisdom can unfold. And then the short sutta ends, these four things, when developed and cultivated, lead to greatness of wisdom. And in another discourse that is phrased exactly along the same line, there's instead of the words greatness of wisdom, it says it leads to the realization of the fruit of stream entry. So if you have these four factors as mentioned, plus the other factors mentioned by you, then it will lead you sooner or later to the realization of at least the first path of stream entry. Now, yet another factor that we should consider or count as conducive to the acquisition of wisdom. And this has to do with the controlling faculties. Namely, if there's some initial amount of or degree of faith in the Buddha's teachings, let's say one hears certainly some Dhamma talk for the first time, and subjectively it makes sense, one feels drawn to it, or one hears from a friend, this Dhamma practice is really good, go and do a retreat, give it a try yourself, you'll gain many benefits. So with this, some amount of faith is there. With this initial faith, we can start working. And this initial faith will then lead to a desire to practice meditation, to do the meditation practice. And once this desire to practice is there, then naturally one will make the necessary effort, and not just once in a minute, but many times in a minute, and many times, even more times in an hour, and then of course many more times in a day. And as one makes effort to again and again send the observing mind, the knowing mind, towards the object of observation, well, gradually then gradually mindfulness arises. And this mindfulness then over time becomes sustained mindfulness, and so based on it the mind becomes more and more collected, unified, concentrated, and it will squarely fall onto the object of observation. It will be fixed to the object of observation. And so in other words, concentration is there. And this concentration, in turn, as we've seen early on in the fourfold definition of wisdom, is the proximate cause for the arising of wisdom. So wisdom will then blossom. So what we have here is faith as the first step leads to wisdom. And add one more aspect in this connection. With the arising of faith and the arising of wisdom is not the end of the story. Let's say the first insight knowledge unfolds in your meditation practice. So you come to discern mind and matter. You see that the rising movement of the abdomen is a physical phenomenon, and you also understand that the labeling, the observation of it, and the knowing of it is a mental or art mental phenomenon. Now, once you have gained this initial wisdom, this first insight knowledge, then you will feel inspired to carry on with the practice. Some faith will arise in you. You see it's working. You're getting the first benefit in the form of the first insight knowledge, and so your faith gets strengthened. At the very outset of the practice, the faith is shaky, is weak. Now it's slightly stronger. It's stronger by one notch. Then, with stronger faith, you'll have an even stronger desire to practice. This will lead you to make even more effort in the practice. This, in turn, leads to better mindfulness, leads to improved concentration, and leads to the arising of the next insight knowledge. And so, and then the second insight knowledge occurs, and it will then again strengthen your faith. So what you have is kind of like a spiral that is moving up and up and up and up, until finally the attainment of the first level of enlightenment takes place. And so the path of stream entry takes place. And with this, one's faith becomes what? Unshakable, yes. So previously, at the very outset of the practice, the faith was somewhat shaky, weak. And you weren't, at that point, you as a meditator, you're not really, or not 100% sure about the validity of the practice. But once you've done it, once you've seen the Four Noble Truths, with the attainment of the first, or with the attainment of stream entry, with this, all doubts are gone. And so, maybe a short story in this connection. Many years ago, when I still lived in Burma as a monastic, the Sangha Mahanayaka organization, the leading synods of the Burmese monastic community nationwide. This Sangha Mahanayaka organization, together with the government, organized a tour to one of the frontier states and of Burma, and it was the Chin state. And so during that, certain I was invited to come along as a foreigner, and so basically they invited me to show me off there and to inspire the Christians in the Chin state. See, the thing is that the Chin state is a state in which during colonial times the Christian missionaries were very active. And as a result of this, until the end of the Second World War, there was a very strong presence of Christian missionaries, and plenty of different churches being present there. And this changed only after 1948, when Burma gained independence, And then only in a very slow manner over many decades, gradually Buddhism started to have some weak influence in this Qin state. And so as a way of promoting Buddhism in the Qin state and also in other states, where the government did these tours. And so the experience from that was that people related how the local villagers would be very inconsistent in their faith. Come a Christian missionary of whatever denomination into their village, with different carrots, like water supply system or a school or first aid clinic or whatnot, plus certain of course some sermons, then the entire village would convert to Christianity. And then maybe a couple of weeks later, some Buddhist missionary monk would show up in this village and give some inspiring Dhamma talk on Four Noble Truths or what have you, and then the entire village would switch denomination, switch faith, and they'd all convert into Buddhism. And then a couple of weeks later, again another Christian missionary would turn up and would propose some other things, and maybe some money and whatnot, and so the villagers would swap or change their faith again. Now, that's the common pattern in the Qin state, and it's a well-known phenomenon. Now, when some of these villagers were introduced to the Pasna meditation, and these villagers then devoted themselves to the practice of Vipassana, and they gained the Dhamma, attained some satisfactory level with this, their faith became unshakable and they no longer were influenced by other missionaries. So this is a very nice illustration how faith in the beginning tends to be shaky, but later on with practice it can become very strong and certain durable faith. Now, in our discussion of faith, it's worth pointing out that there are in our discussion of wisdom, we're not on faith anymore, that there are different kinds of understanding or wisdom. And I'll mention just a few categories that are helpful. Wisdom can be said to be to have one single essence, or to be of one kind, in the sense that it has the characteristic of penetrating the individual essences of formations. So whatever type of wisdom you have, whatever insight knowledge you might experience, the fundamental essence is that of seeing or penetrating the intrinsic nature of an object. And wisdom is said to be of two kinds, namely as mundane wisdom and supramundane wisdom. Now, mundane wisdom covers all the insight knowledges up to or except for what? Pardon me? Selflessness? Not quite. And Nibbana, yes, and there you go. Now, the path and fruition of stream entry. And so those two are so special in nature and so different from all the other mundane forms of wisdom, then these are known as supramundane wisdom. They go beyond the mundane level. And they're connected with the noble path of path knowledge and fruition knowledge. Then there's a threefold classification of wisdom, namely as wisdom that arises out of thinking. Sutta Meya Panya in the Pali scriptural language. So, simply out of thinking, reflection, or analysis, a certain knowledge can be gained. And this is what we make use of all the time in the field of education at the university and so on. And it's important to have this particular quality. And then there's another form of knowledge. And this is knowledge by hearing. This will be the literal translation, Sutta Meya Panya. And this is knowledge gained through listening to some lecture on some worldly topic, or participating in a discussion, or reading books, and so on. So it's knowledge that one gains from others. And then comes the third form of knowledge. And this is knowledge that, or knowledge or wisdom that arises out of meditation practice. And this in Pali is known as Bhavana Meya Panya. And please keep in mind that this kind of wisdom is much more, or goes much deeper than the other two kinds of knowledge mentioned earlier on. So you can read 100 books on Nibbana and you will still not understand what is meant by it. Or you can hear 100 discourses on Nibbana and you will still not understand what is meant by it. Same thing for anatta. And you can read plenty of books on maybe on psychology and whatnot, and they may change your behavior only in slight ways, somewhat on the surface. When it comes to changing very powerful motivations such as greed or hatred, ordinary knowledge gained through reading books or so, it cannot, or it's not, or it can, doesn't go very deep, and it cannot bring about major changes. However, this wisdom gained out of mental development, and this is what we're doing here, this wisdom can be very powerful. So powerful that, as we've seen early on, it can abandon certain wrongful perceptions, it can abandon or substitute certain wrongful views or ideas, notions, concepts, and ultimately it leads to the eradication, the uprooting of certain mental defilements, once and forever. So permanently they are gone. And so what we really need to work at is this wisdom that arises out of mental development. Now, the unfolding of wisdom does not happen in a haphazard manner. It's not that you join a retreat and then you gain the first insight knowledge, and then, like a frog, you jump into the experience of Nibbana. It would be nice if it would happen like this, but simply that's just not the case. But rather, does the practice unfold in a very systematic manner. A meditator has to do some preliminary work in order to gain the first insight knowledge, and then once this has been gained, and then he or she has to go on with the practice and certain factors have to be developed, and then when a certain maturity is there, then eventually the second insight knowledge will unfold, and so on and so forth. It is only in the middle phase of on the path to Nibbana, that there is a set of three insight knowledges, and sometimes meditators skip one of those, one or two of those knowledges, and experience only one of them, one or two. However, later on, each and every one will arise fully or completely. Now, when we look at the unfolding of one insight knowledge, and let's say standard insight knowledge standing for all of them, then we can say that usually there is first an observation of material phenomena. And to put it differently, first the meditator has to deal with the aggregate of materiality, rupa khanda. So objects that are part of this aggregate. And so a meditator has to work with observing the rising and falling movement of the abdomen, pains, aches, and heat and cold, and other physical sensations. Once this has been done to some extent, the practice moves on. Oftentimes it goes unnoticed by the meditator, and he or she then will predominantly experience feelings. And please, it's not emotions, but feelings, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral feelings. So these the aggregate of feelings will be in the foreground of a meditator's practice. Then, once this area has been covered, then the practice moves on, and perceptions tend to come into the foreground. So just the bare perception, bare seeing process, bare hearing process, and so on. And later on, the mental formations, mental states, come into the foreground. So it doesn't mean that the other aggregates fall away. They're still present, but the emphasis will be on mental formations for a while. So one works with these, or with them, one knows them. And finally, especially in the higher insight knowledges, the aggregate of consciousness is or comes up in one's practice. And at that point, a meditator then gets some understanding of what is meant by consciousness. And usually, once the practice has, or a particular insight knowledge has developed up to this level, then insight itself takes place. So an intuitive understanding, a particular intuitive understanding, unfolds. And so once this intuitive understanding has come up, then this insight knowledge is accomplished, and then the practice moves into the next insight knowledge. And then basically it's again along the same pattern. Now, please, within a 10-day retreat, you might not necessarily see this as clearly as it has been mentioned now, the thing with the aggregates. However, if you were to do a long-term retreat for several months, then these patterns become quite clear. And now, also, once a meditator has gained some ground in the practice and progressed to the third insight knowledge, where an understanding of anicca, dukkha, and anatta takes place, then from that point onwards, these three universal characteristics will come up again and again. So in a further or higher insight knowledge, you might find that there is a subdivision of first phase mostly connected with impermanence, and then a phase mostly connected with unsatisfactoriness or dukkha, and then a phase connected with anatta, non-self, or absence of a self. And then eventually the intuitive insight will unfold. And so it follows from all of this that usually an intuitive insight occurs not at the beginning of or during the immature stage of an insight knowledge, but rather at the end, when the knowledge comes to maturity. Keep in mind that each and every insight knowledge will go along with a very specific set of physical as well as mental symptoms. So in one particular insight knowledge, you might experience plenty of pains and aches. And then in another insight knowledge, you might experience plenty of itching sensations on the face, other parts of the body. And in one particular insight knowledge, you might find that you're trying to sit upright, however, again and again, you end up sitting like this. And that's just part of the practice. That's just the way it is. And so do pay attention to the physical as well as mental phenomena as they are occurring in your practice. And you will notice by now, or you will have understood by now, that things keep changing. So your predominant experiences keep changing or keep evolving as time goes on. Now, since it's already 20 minutes to 7, let's stop at this point. There's more to say. Let me conclude today's Dhamma talk by wishing that may you be well grounded or well established in virtue, and then in the course of the practice develop plenty of thought and concentration, and with this may wisdom unfold in leaps and bounds, and may eventually the peace of Nibbana be yours. And this is it. Some time for questions. Yes, Gaia.
I want to ask you for the benefit of myself. Okay. So I wanted to say for myself, maybe for others, you can practice Buddhism, and you can be Christian and practice Buddhism. You can practice Vipassana, but for me, it's not coming in any contradiction with the fact that.
Oh, let's put it this way. The Christians who practice this kind of Vipassana meditation indeed feel enriched through it, and they feel that it helps their understanding of deepens their own faith or religion. And so we had a staff meeting on this topic, and the consensus was that there are certain common factors that go across the board, no matter what the religion is. And Gaya, what you said is, I think those are the essential points, namely that the practice indeed helps helps the person to become a better person, to become a person with more wholesome mental states, and thus more loving kindness towards others, more compassion towards others, and more sympathetic joy, more equanimity, and more wisdom is there, more understanding is there. Maybe one limitation or addition. This Vipassana practice, at least for some people, helps some people to then also, or the Vipassana practice for some people is a wonderful introduction to Buddhism, and eventually they opt to take up this faith. But I don't think that this is exclusive. So it doesn't mean that the other faith is excluded. Does this answer it? Yes. How this happens? Oh, could you, all the people in the back, they can't hear. Please speak up. The answer is very very simple. Through the experience of path consciousness. So path consciousness is one particular, it's a very particular form of consciousness, and it occurs, and there's only one such moment for each level of enlightenment, and with this, with the occurrence of this particular path consciousness, a certain number of or varying number of mental defilements will be uprooted from the mind once and forever. And in the case of the second level of enlightenment, two mental defilements get weakened but not fully uprooted. So that's greed and hatred. And basically, when this path consciousness takes place, it's kind of like a burning away of certain unwholesome mental states, and they simply, after this experience, they simply don't occur in the mind anymore. And so you practice, you bring your practice all the way up to equanimity, and then you have to ensure the balance of the controlling faculties, of the enlightenment factors, and when everything is, all the necessary conditions are present, then this path consciousness takes place. And this experience also has to do, there's some more preliminary steps which I'm not going to reveal. You have to find out for yourself. I don't know. In this connection, it's really best to, not to have too much knowledge, prior knowledge. Yeah. And then, yes, your question?
C1?
Could you speak up?
In the Buddhism faith, do you have the belief that you choose?
I choose? No.
Okay,
this happens, this depending on one's actions and karmic results. A series of moments of consciousness, one after the other, coming and going, or otherwise differently put, there's a series of nama rupa processes going on. Moments of mentality and materiality.
Yes, but mentality and
materiality. No. After the body is gone, there's, as explained in one of the earlier Dhamma talks, if I'm not mistaken, there is, at the end of this present existence, there is the so-called death consciousness, no? And then all the karmic potential from this existence will be in this death consciousness, and this potential will be passed on to the next consciousness, which is the rebirth thinking consciousness.
What is this consciousness?
What is it? Energy? Itself is defined as that which cognizes. So that's all. But practice some more, and you'll see differently. No, you'll understand differently. No, and maybe to add to your first certain question, or to the answer to the first question, namely, just before this death consciousness occurs, a so-called gati nimitta arises. Nimitta is a sign, and gati is a realm or an abode, namely the realm or place in which you will be reborn in the next existence. So a sign of that will come up. So maybe you're on the deathbed, and an image of some heavenly palace or whatnot comes up. I have no experience. I don't know. No, that's supposed to happen that way. And then you will be reborn in that certain realm.
Right away.
No, right away.
No,
no, no. And
no,
see, no. There's no rest. There's no resting period. And there's a difference here in understanding between Theravada Buddhism and Tibetan Buddhism. So in Tibetan Buddhism, you will know, the consciousness will go on in the bardo. No, it's kind of on a loop there, and they're waiting to find some, I don't know, the right parents or so.
Oh, so they do believe in the end.
That's in Tibetan Buddhism. But in Theravada Buddhism, the understanding is that if this is death consciousness, then this would be immediately followed by rebirth linking consciousness of the next existence. Now, the practicalities of these, how consciousness goes into the right parent or mother's womb, this I don't know.
I don't understand why it should be different.
Well. See, in this world, you have one object like this, and depending on from which angle you look at it, you get a different impression or different perception, and you might interpret it differently. These absolute the questions of who is right and what, or what is right and what is wrong, it's very difficult to say. And especially if you practice in one tradition, and so you're familiar with one tradition, but you're not really familiar with another tradition, you haven't practiced in that, so then how to know what is correct? Yes, please.
I want to ask about mindfulness, and I'm trying my best to practice all day long, but when I'm coming to bed, when I'm lying down, can you give some instructions?
Yeah, it's a very nice question, and I have a nice story to tell in this connection. Namely, the Venerable Mahasi Sayadaw recommends that meditators, while they assume the lying posture, or in the lying posture, that as usual, as in sitting, focus your attention on the rising movement and falling movement of the abdomen, and you just keep observing as usual, and you may find that you might even have some clear experiences. And the Venerable Mahasi Sayadaw went to the extent of asking meditators during interviews, last night when you fell asleep, did you fall asleep on a rising movement or on a falling movement? So, if your mindfulness is that sharp, and that you still, and you can remember on the, you know, whether rising or falling you fell asleep, then you probably have very good practice. And it's really difficult to do. And so, now, in a wait a minute, yeah, okay, your question. Yes.
What takes it after while you realize the changes when you're in a happy
state? Yes.
How come?
Well, okay. Good. Well, it's a good question. Now, it changes owing to different factors. One very important factor is the power of mindfulness. So it's just your mindfulness sati. And through observing the unhappiness again and again and again and again, gradually it loses its power over, you know, over the mind. And in particular, when you learn to observe the unhappiness in a detached manner, disidentifying from it, so you just see it as one actor on, you know, on the stage performing there, you know? And so, and then when the, you know, mindfulness is quite strong, or it's through mindfulness that the mind will be protected against unwholesome mental states, in this case unhappiness, and it is with the help of concentration that the unhappiness will be suppressed, and, you know, effort, viriya, has the kind of, you know, functions as keeping this unhappiness at a bay or at a distance. No, so these are three, you know, factors work together, and so then with the arising of wisdom, seeing reality for what it is. The wisdom may help you to dispel the ignorance regarding, you know, that unhappiness, and so you see unhappiness really clearly for what it is, and so, you know, by that time it will, you know, have lost its power, and then, especially in the presence of mindfulness, happiness has a fair chance to arise in the stream of consciousness. Well, unhappy is, so unhappiness or unpleasant, unhappy, you know, this is the opposite of sukha. So in other words, dukkha, and it technically it comes under feeling, the mental factor of feeling, vedana. And this feeling is one of the seven universals. So it arises together with all consciousness. No, so its presence, mindfulness can be, or mindfulness definitely will be present when this dukkha is there or unhappiness is there. No? So, then, yes, please, Rahuma.
In your question, you talked about keeping the unhappiness at bay, and I'm wondering if you...
See, each mental factor works differently, works in a very specific way. So, with the help of mindfulness, the mind, you explore, you know, the object, the unhappiness, and so, and you just explore it as it is, in a detached manner, neither liking nor disliking it, and so it is the mental factor of effort that with which you then distance the object, or even you try to abandon it. No. So that's where more the active part comes in, into you try to get rid of it. However, an effort will not do the exploration. No. So mindfulness, with mindfulness you explore, with effort you keep at a distance. No. And the idea in the Vipassana practice is that with an unwholesome mental state, especially unwholesome mental state, but also wholesome mental states, you are mindful of it for some period of time until you really know its nature quite well. Once you know this particular mental factor quite well, as an example, greed, and you know it's unwholesome, you know that it's giving you trouble, and then the effort comes in and you try to abandon it quickly. No? So at the beginning of the practice, it's always wise to explore the different mental factors. Later on, with more experience, understanding of what is what and how they work, you try to let go of them quickly. It's correct. This is correct to say. And indeed, some Vipassana teachers stress just this. And they say, just observe, don't do anything else. And wait until the respective unwholesome mental state is dissolves by itself. And so then observe the next object. However, since time is limited, and like we have only 10 days, you don't want to observe the same unwholesome mental state again and again and again and again. And so, therefore, it's advisable to make use of effort as a mental factor, and then push the issue a little bit, and then let go of the unwholesome mental state. I'll give you a good example. After a few days of meditation practice, you will understand that wandering mind is not helping your practice a lot. No? And so, after a few days, you will know the nature of wandering mind, and then you'll come to the point where you naturally don't like the wandering mind anymore. No? And at that point, naturally you will want to get rid of it, and that's where the effort comes in. No. And this then will make for quick progress in the practice. So yeah, absolutely, it's absolutely correct. No.
So the likelihood of it coming up again in that case is not that high.
Pardon me?
So it's not likely that if it's truly observed and penetrated.
Oh, sure enough. Some strong mental factors may arise many times. No. Especially when you are on a longer retreat of several months. Then in the beginning of the practice, you might think, oh well, now I've seen wandering mind already so many times, with the strength of mindfulness it should dissolve altogether, it should disappear totally. You'll be disappointed, because even after 3 months, the wandering mind might still arise. But that's, in a sense, it's not bad, because you really get a chance to work with it, to look at it repeatedly, and it's with this repetition of the observation that the respective unwholesome mental state loses its power. No. See, to bring about these changes in the mind, it does take quite a lot of work. And it's not that you sit down and after a couple of days or so, you have a different mindset. No, it would be nicer if it were that way, but it's not working that way. No, so it takes, from a meditator's point of view, it takes a lot of determination and patience to be with whatever arises. No. Okay, then we've got, yes. asat. To say, it's hard to say whether Albert Einstein, you know, really, you know, gained all of these insight knowledges. We would have to, you know, very carefully, you know, go, you know, through his biographies and whatnot. And all. Are you an Einstein expert? Yeah, me neither.
There are some Albert Einstein was brilliant indeed, like everybody else knows. So he had a in that sense, there was no sign of he had a lot of attachment.
Yeah.
I think that would in his life manifested some that kind of wisdom. Two types of wisdom mixed here.
Yeah, right.
Okay, so let me put it differently. If you meet someone, you can meet him either at the university, in the martial arts dojo, or in the martial arts. There's something in his face, you see. We call it enlightened without getting into Buddhism. But he has great intuition, he's happy most of the time, he's not suffering. Not attached to certain things, he's not slave to his senses. Then this man could be placed in that
state. Again, Well, dear Asaf, there are different type of spiritual peak experiences around, as you will know. And some people have indeed some amount of restraint of the senses, and or not attached to sense impressions, and are quite impressive. But the question arises from a Buddhist perspective, have they really understood the Four Noble Truths? And there's in this world there's so many different spiritual paths or practices around that it's very hard to say what a person really has seen or not seen. Sure enough, if somebody comes in there is a sutta. There's a sutta in the a discourse in the text that says, if you want to find out another person's integrity and also courage and so on, and then you have to associate with this person for a longer period of time. So you have to be, especially for the integrity, you have to be with the person for some time, and then you see in practice. And so for wisdom, for the wisdom aspect, I think it was you have to converse with this person and simply hear what the person says and the views that come, the views that are being that get expressed.
I got a personal question about the sleeping state. I'm very concentrated while I'm sleeping since I'm here.
You mean when you're in bed?
Yes.
Sleeping.
While I'm sleeping, I can concentrate. And I remember it when I wake up.
What?
The concentration.
Huh?
Yeah. And I have many dreams, and I remember usually I don't.
This is a common experience on Vipassana retreats among meditators, that it seems that the Vipassana practice indeed, just like you say, enhances one's dreams. So enhances means strength, makes them really clear. So meditators tend to have vivid dreams, clear-cut dreams on retreat. Not all, but a number of them. And so this may, I'm not 100% sure, but this may have to do with the fact that when you're practicing, you're developing the controlling faculties, wholesome mental states, mindful, faith, effort, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. And so as a result of this, your concentration will already be quite strong. And so then this might contribute to these clearer dreams. and not. Plus, it's not not only the concentration, but the awareness itself. No, you train when you're on retreat. You're training in awareness, no, being aware. So maybe this quality, or probably the mindfulness that you've developed in the course of one day, well, it doesn't get lost. It doesn't get totally lost while you're asleep. And so when you dream, probably some amount of awareness is there, no? And I know of the meditators on retreat in Lumbini, who have, actually quite a number of them, who have said, when waking up in the middle of the night and turning over from one side to the other, automatically the noting was there. Turning. And when, and person saying even left turn, right turn. And coming automatically. So this is amazing. During ordinary life, this doesn't happen.
I was very careful not to say really sharp feelings.
Good. So what we can see from this is that indeed, when you're on retreat and practicing intensively, then many of our areas of our lives change. So sleeping patterns may change, and even eating patterns may change, and we get by with less food, less than usual, in terms of sleep, later on one needs less sleep. Or even in terms of respiration, the respiration becomes more shallow, and I think the blood, I think, breathing slows down, and the blood pressure, the blood pressure, or the heartbeat, I think it's a heartbeat or so, also changes. So there are some very clear-cut physiological as well as mental changes that occur in the course of the practice. And so to bring it to a point, if the right conditions are there, a merger can be turned into an arahant. So the famous example of Angulimala, a person who had murdered, by some accounts, 99 persons, another account is 999 persons, and then met the Buddha, and the Buddha tamed him, and the Buddha gave him then some meditation or topic to meditate on, and eventually he became an arahant. Arahant is a holy one, it's the highest level of enlightenment. So, out of a merger, becomes a saint. So that's a huge change. It's already again 7:20. So maybe let's end at this point. If you have some more questions, then raise them tomorrow.